Well, I was very struck about halfway through the event this year, and this was my first MUC convention, I was very struck by realizing that what I was seeing, I mean, I knew a good bit about the Washington Lee student body, and I knew how conservative it was, and I could feel the enthusiasm, and I thought to myself, what has it been like the previous three conventions? How did they get this much enthusiasm up? And that's my question. Was there really the same level of enthusiasm?
It's funny. I can't explain why and how it happened, but it was not that much different. I mean, I had a different perspective because I was on different sides of the podium for the two conventions, and so I saw it a little bit differently. I don't know. I didn't see what it was like to be out in the crowd in 92. But, you know, it's if you look at the video and you look at the tapes and you talk to people that were there, I mean, it was a very enthusiastic crowd. I mean, people gave standing ovations, you know, to Michael Dukakis, which it's hard to imagine, really, when you think about, you know, the place that WNL is. And I don't think it was a complete sham. I don't think that many people voted for Dukakis in 88, and I don't think that too many voted for Clinton in 92. But the enthusiasm for the event and for what they were doing was certainly genuine.
Well, I was tickled by it. Yeah. I just thought it was fascinating.
It was a neat experience.
Now, another thing I read in the magazine is that you're the ones who instigated the idea of having the big video screen.
Yes.
That was the first time?
First time. That was, yeah. The video and the sound part were probably probably my favorite aspect of the whole thing. Bill Parks, who's a WNL grad, and has been involved in all three, well, since 84 he's been involved in the technical production part of the MUC convention, came up with this screen, and I think they got a bigger one in 96, you know, as is the normal course of history, but yeah, we got the big screen, and that was pretty dramatic. It made it look a lot more authentic or more like the modern conventions, and we had a pretty good sound system as well, and tried to keep the music going at all times. And we had a few bands that came in and played, and just tried to make it kind of a really realistic modern convention that way, as opposed to try to make it feel less like the gym.
It had a very authentic feel to it.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's the same place that they, you know, teach.
And you got really good media coverage.
Yes, we did. And that was, that again goes back to timing and the speakers. I mean, I think those are the two central components to a successful one, because we had interesting speakers, Cuomo especially, because at the time there was still the rumor that he might throw his hat in the ring, and that attracted a lot of people. And that, you know, people giggle about it now, but it was a very real possibility at the time. And we had news articles written about the MUC convention and the possibility that it could be a possible place for him to at least hint at getting involved, and he didn't, which was fine, but just the prospect of that got a lot of extra news coverage there. And Roger Mudd was a tremendous help in
tell me about that. What
adding
did he
some
do?
Legitimacy. Well, what we did, we put together two videos before the convention itself. One was directed at getting speakers and media, and it was about an 8-minute video, and it was one that we sent out to prospective speakers and news organizations, just to say this is a real thing. We're not It's not going to be like, you know, showing up at a high school gym. And that was also produced by Bill Parks, and that was something that I worked with Professor DeMaria on putting on editing and putting together.
Had that ever been done before?
No. Oh, no, I take that back. They did. I'm trying to remember. I think they actually did a short one before, but it was more of a, they did do one, and it was either in 80 or 84. But that was more of a summary of the convention. What we wanted was a selling piece. And so we talked to, we went up and interviewed Roger Mudd and Senator Warner and Charlie McDowell and Stephen Danzansky, who was one of Bush's cabinet members. And, you know, here we are, we got the W&L video equipment and just kind of showed up. And interviewed all them and asked them about their mock convention experiences, and then came back and put this thing into kind of a media package, and it was great because we had, you know, we had these guys saying what a good thing this was. I mean, these were mostly people that they recognized and knew wouldn't get involved in suspect, you know, undertakings, and we were also able to throw in footage of every, you know, national speaker who'd been there. I mean, there was Clinton in 88, there was, you know, shots of Truman and Nixon and, you know, all these different folks, which just kind of really, I think, presented a very attractive marketing piece to the news organizations and speakers. So that helped a lot. And that was a pretty neat experience just in terms of, you know, going on and, you know, getting 20 minutes with John Warner and or Roger Mudd and Charlie McDowell, and it was a pretty neat experience.
Well, I'm glad to know that exists.
It does. Dee Maria's got it. You gotta.
I'm gonna go take a look at
pin
that.
Pin him down on that. Brian's probably got it too.
Well, I need more on my convention, and that would be a nice succinct.
Do you have? There's also, I think that the news office put it together a. Summary of the major news stories from 92. It's got the there was a McNeil Air piece, which is I mean that was phenomenal, and that was all Roger Mudd's doing. I mean, that was about a, you know, 12 or 13 minute piece, which is, if you can imagine that, I mean, that's you know, Roger Mudd's campaign contribution through the century, I think. I mean, it was a full McNeil Air piece on it, and then CBS had a story on it, and then I'm trying to remember who else. There were a few others on there too, but that was pretty amazing, really. And Brian's got that, I know.
Oh, and McNeil Laird did it again this year.
Yeah, they did.
In 96, they did a long piece.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't ask for
no,
more wonderful.
You can't buy coverage like that. No, that's true.
It's just, to me, it's remarkable what you guys pulled together.
Well, it's a real collective effort. I mean, it's the university puts tremendous support behind the convention, and they are very flexible and accommodating in terms of scheduling and certainly you know, keeping an eye on the people that are involved and making sure that they're, you know, not doomed academically, and the alumni too. I mean, the amount of financial and connection support is really impressive. It's a great event, and it pulls the university together in a way not too many school-sponsored events do, because you get the law school tied in, you get the faculty involved and the students, and it's a shame it's over so quick in a lot of ways, because it takes a long time in preparing, but that's not unlike a lot of things.
How do you keep your nose above water academically?
It was a struggle.
Do you get any academic credit for what you do?
No, No, although I from what I understand, the last group did get some independent study credit for it. I mean, not
I would
a,
think
not a
so.
Lot. Yeah, yeah. No, I got some academic credit for putting with Professor DeMaria for putting the videos together, and he was quite helpful in that regard, and it was a great learning experience too. I mean, I wasn't totally screwing around. It was I did learn a lot about filmmaking and that kind of thing, but I mean the fact that the university will let a bunch of 19 to 21 year olds run an organization with a $250,000 budget is just, it is unbelievable. I mean, the trust that that the university places on you is really, it's daunting almost. I mean, it's difficult to find too many out of college jobs that you would get that kind of responsibility with. And it's something that, you walk away feeling a lot stronger about WL because of. I mean, that doesn't happen at many other places. I mean, I went to Virginia to law school and was involved in a few things there. And I mean, to get, $25 for paper clips, it's, you got to go through 48 channels and appeal and, get everybody to sign off on there. Gosh, there were days when we spent $30,000 and there was no university, true supervision. I mean, there was, obviously we were accountable for it all, but that's pretty unusual these days.
It's pretty unusual anytime, mm-hmm. anywhere.
Right.
Well, you meant this whole idea of what makes Washington and Lee different is a theme I'm trying mm-hmm. to pursue. And obviously Mock Convention is one of the major manifestations of it, but the whole idea of the honor system mm-hmm. and how there's student self-government. What did that mean to you as a student, and what has it meant to you now that you're not a student anymore?
Well, I think the freedom that allows you and the trust that the university and the community places on you, that was probably, that is really the defining part of the WNL experience for me. I mean, that was, that freedom to, to run an organization like Mock Convention with, really without too much of a safety net below you. I mean, And I say that in the positive sense. Well, it builds up your confidence in a way that I think would be almost impossible anyplace else without having to deal with all of somebody constantly looking over your shoulder. I mean, it just at a young age it gave me the confidence to handle pretty significant life experiences and It's having seen it, I mean, having gone to another school, which was also a great place to be, but very different, I just appreciated it so much more. And the freedom and the trust that you have at WNL, I mean, it's just, it makes it such a more pleasant place to be. And overall, I think you come away with a stronger experience because of that. It's kind of rambling, but
let's talk about the honor system. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you first learned about it?
Yeah, I think the first time that I really got into the nuts and bolts of it was at the honor orientation, which of course is mandatory for freshmen right after you enroll, and that's pretty heady stuff when you're 18. You go into the Lee Chapel and you've got somebody who's either a senior or a law student that puts across the responsibility that comes with the freedom that you have under the honor system. And you're in the Lee Chapel and everybody, it's a pretty it's a pretty, not, I wouldn't say nerve-wracking, but the seriousness of it certainly gets across. And then you kind of break down into groups and you talk about what is and what is not an honor violation. Rico? I just completely lost my train of thought. And you really, you know, you think about how that's going to affect your life at W&L and about how you need, not necessarily to change, but just to be aware of it on a regular, on a constant basis. I mean, what might have been okay in high school, not in terms of cheating or just, but just, you just need to be always aware that your actions have got consequences that you just need to be conscious of. And I'm trying to remember, I don't know that there were any honor trials my freshman year. I think there was one, and that's when you really, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road on the honor system. I mean, when you're there for a public honor trial, I mean, that's just unusual is a mild way of describing it in terms of a university putting all the cards in the students' hands in evaluating actions of other students. And that it's it, those honor trials are pretty scary. Have you been? No. It's you definitely walk away from those thinking long and hard about honor and what it is and how it applies to your daily life.
Tell me about that. Tell me about the experience of going to the trial.
Well, these were people that I knew. I mean, they weren't, I wouldn't say good friends, but they were people that I knew socially. I knew, you know, I'd had classes with them. And it's pretty scary, you know. I mean, to sit there and, you know, have all those issues played out and knowing in the back of your mind that there's a good chance that they're not going to be at W&L next week because of it. The first one that I went to, they were actually exonerated in the end. And the thing to remember is the only reason, I can't remember how the mechanics of it work, but I know in their case, they had actually been found, I don't remember what the term of choice is, guilty or convicted by the executive committee. And so the reason that they were there is because they were basically expelled by the executive committee and were rolling the dice with an open trial, meaning if they had just left following their being found guilty by the EC, it wouldn't have been on the transcript. By taking it to an honor trial, you are setting yourself up, potentially at least, to have a tremendous stigma on your record and resume and life. It's uncomfortable to sit and watch that, knowing that in the back of your mind, but at the same time, I mean, you realize that's the price for having all the freedom that you do at W&L. And it's impossible to walk away from there without, you know, talking to other people about it and thinking about just how you conduct your life. And it's something that has stuck with me down the road. There was an honor trial my last year there where they were found guilty, and that was one of the strangest experiences I've ever been in my entire life. I mean, when the guilty verdict came down, I mean, Lee Chapel was absolutely dead silent. And nobody really knew what to do. I mean, do you walk out? Do you let them walk out? Do you, and eventually people kind of got up and milled around, and, but it was very, very strange. And wouldn't want to go through that process, that's for sure.
What happened the first time when the person was exonerated?
Well, that was actually in the law school moot courtroom, and I think that was different because the verdict came back pretty quick, and so people didn't have time to go, because a lot of people kind of come in and out for those, and a lot of people did not have time to get up and back to the law school before the verdict was read. And so there weren't a lot of people there. It was mostly these people's friends, and it was kind of a cheering, kind of, you know, congratulatory atmosphere. The other trial was in the chapel, and it was jam packed. And I think that the verdict had there was an announcement that the verdict had been reached, and so people were able to get down there pretty quick. And so the chapel was just about packed, as I recall, and you could hear a pin drop after that verdict was read.
What is it about Lee Chapel? You're implying both when you went for the explanation that there's something loaded about Lee Chapel.
No doubt about that. I mean, well, you've got the recumbent statue of General Lee. You've got the portraits of Lee and Washington. I mean, you know, the chapel really is the center of W&L. I mean, it's there's so much history tied up there. I mean, you look down and you see, you know, this the pew where General Lee, you know, went to services while he was there. You look around and you see the plaques about alumni who've accomplished and done great things throughout there. It's also a very stark place. I mean, it's the starkness is part of its attraction, but it's also it has a very, I don't know what the real term would be, but it's got a very solemn feel to it. And to have an honor trial there, I mean it's the appropriate place for that. And I think it adds to the gravity of the proceedings to have it in the chapel. It's sort of a, you know, not to use a bad term, but kind of a temple of the honor system. And to have it there, it really, you know, it's a much, much different experience than if you have it in the courtroom. I mean, the courtroom has this kind of... Well, it feels like a courtroom. I mean, that's what its intention is, and the chapel just kind of takes it up a level, I think, in some ways.
I'm sure it does.
That was a really, really strange experience. Seeing a guilty verdict read there, and it was spring term, I think, my senior year, and so, you know, you're on your way out, and it's a good. It's not a good, but it certainly makes you reconsider or think about the honor system and its place and your role within it.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's an experience I hope I get to see for history's sake, but I hope it doesn't happen at the same time.
You're right.
It's not something you wish for to happen to anyone.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, the honor system at W&L works, I think, well because it's a small university. People generally know each other pretty well. It also works because it's in a small town where you don't have as much outside influence and possible intrusion. I mean, I don't know whether an honor system would not work as well at NYU as it does in Lexington. There are just too many external forces that would bear down on it. And even in Charlottesville, which is a much bigger place, the honor system is very different there. It's not as much a part of your kind of walking around life as it is at WNL. I mean, the honor system comes at Virginia, and obviously I was a grad student, so it's a little bit different than I think it is for undergraduates. But it, for us, came into play just around exam time, which meant there weren't proctors and you weren't allowed to discuss the exams, which is also, I mean, which is great. I mean, it gives you a lot of flexibility in that regard, but it's not the same omnipresent part of life that the honor system is at WNL.
So you're saying at UVA it has to do with exams, whereas at WNL it has to do with life?
Well, that's not exactly true. I mean, you, and again, because I was a grad student, I wasn't kind of involved in too much of it. There aren't a lot of grad students that get put before an honor committee hearing because of cheating or, well, because of law school exams are hard to cheat on. I mean, in the best of circumstances, but or for stealing or for lying. I don't even know if the lying really applies as much at Virginia. Although, I think the president at UVA was expelled for an honor violation while I was there. But because WNL was smaller and because you tend to know people, it's a topic of conversation more often. There's a lot of trust that the, I mean, you're just constantly reminded, you know, that you go in the library and there's no gate blocking your entrance. I mean, that's completely different than most major university libraries. And so you think about it a lot more. You think about, you know, about what you're doing and about how that applies in the context of the honor system.
Okay, another thing that I think you were there for,
mm-hmm.
I think you were there for the bulk of it, for Fraternity Renaissance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're the first person I've talked to who lived through Fraternity Renaissance. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I started in 88 and pledged 88, 89, and then moved into the fraternity house in 89. I was a beta. And I was the, well, let me think just a second. Yeah, I was the last class to live in the house before Reconstruction, because I think that began in 1991, and then we were back in the house for my senior year, 91, 92. It's totally different. I mean, you can't, I mean, those houses were, it's hard to believe that I lived in a structure like that. I mean, at the time, it didn't seem so bad, but I mean, it was, all those houses were really 5 years from collapse. I mean, they could not have continued much longer along that course.
What course?
Of reckless disregard for them. I mean, you know, you we would try to clean up for alumni weekend and for parents weekend and that sort of thing, but you just can't get past the inherent structural damage. And kind of, you know, polish up a dung heap. I mean, it was they were that far gone. And they were, because they were, it's difficult to pinpoint the source of the problem, but the general conditions fostered kind of a pretty reckless atmosphere in terms of, you know, window breaking was pretty common, and people just didn't have any respect for the house, for the structure itself. And that changed pretty dramatically. I think those days, I was glad to have experienced both. And I don't know what it's, I don't know 5 years into it how the process has gone. I don't know what the reviews are, but I think overall it was time for that change. the fraternities sacrificed a lot of their autonomy by signing over the deeds to the houses, but frankly, you know, 90% of the fraternities couldn't have afforded that kind of a rebuilding of the house. And so I think it was an equitable trade in the long run. And I think it's unprecedented that the you know, that a university puts that much financial capital and resources and effort behind the fraternity system. You know, there was a lot of talk at the time about, you know, this is just an effort by the Hill to come down and take charge, and then, you know, this is going to be the German-speaking house at one point, and next door is going to be, you know, the French house or whatever. But I think WNL is the kind of place that there aren't too many subterfuges that way to usurp power. And you know, the commitment that the university has put behind it is really unbelievable. Other schools, I mean, it's antagonistic is a euphemism for what for the relationship between, you know, the colleges and the fraternities. WNL is embracing them and you know, saying that this is an important part of our history and will continue to be. And that's great.
So the houses were in ill repair. You moved out. What did you do that year?
Yeah, that year was pretty terrible.
What was it like? I mean, I've seen some pictures, but describe it for me.
You know, they did them all in phases. And so we were, I think, the second round of how, well, the first was SAE, and then I think then they did PICA, then they did Red Square next.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were out that whole stretch. And that was, it was
all of Red Square was done?
I think simultaneously, I think that's right. They did Phi Cap and Sigma Nu and Beta, Phi Del, Pica, all at the same time. And then they did that second wave after that. The third wave, I guess, technically. But it was tough. I mean, you know, the houses were the center of fraternity life. And when you take that away and you've got people living all over town, I mean, it was a difficult year socially for all the fraternities. Some of the more, you know, cohesive fraternities had a less hard time, but
How did they solve it?
Well, they rented out different warehouses in town and made those kind of the regular band places and party places. But when you don't eat together all the time and you don't have a place to come down to after classes, it's hard. It puts a lot of pressure on these social events to be the unifying forces within the fraternities. So that year was pretty tough. I mean, you know, there were things kind of spread all over the place. You didn't have Red Square parties. You had a lot more country parties. There was a lot more driving as a result. You know, people had to drive out of town. With the incumbent risks that brings, but then that was for all of junior year, and then I came back my senior year and the houses were done, and it was a tremendous change. I mean, to walk into what really had been a, you know, a rubbish heap to this sparkling new house. With a house mother, of all things. I mean, that was a dramatic change from what we were used to. And it made fraternity life a lot more expensive, and for that reason, you know, I think that's a negative, because the houses were nicer, the rent's gone up, the food has gone up in price as well, from what I understand. Dues went up to pay for the new houses, and so I hope that doesn't exclude people too much from joining fraternities. I know I had a battle with my old man to try to get him to pay my dues, and I don't know what they are now, but he probably wouldn't pay them if they were much higher than they were 5 years ago. But it was a big change. I mean, our house mother came in and said no sleepovers, no hats at dinner, no, you know. And I mean, the fraternities prior to that were the center of, you know, male life. There were no real restrictions other than those imposed by the fraternity members. And to have somebody come in and start making rules, it took a little bit of adjustment, you know. And I think eventually, there was a mutual consensus put together about, I mean, I think that our house mother at least kind of backed off some of her strident rules, and we kind of cleaned up our act a little bit, and we met in the middle, and for that it's worked out. It seemed to work out pretty well at the time.
Are there university rules, or are they the house mother's rules? And who?
Well, I think they're both. I mean, there are certainly heightened restrictions on what you can and can't do in the fraternity house itself from the university. I mean, they sunk a lot of money into it, and I think they have every right to want to protect their investment. But the house mother brought on sort of social rules that we weren't used to. And took a little bit of getting used to.
What kinds of things?
Well, no girl sleepovers, no hats at the dinner table. I can't remember. Those were two that seemed to bring up a lot of flack, I guess. There's a lot of resistance to those. I'm trying to think what other kind of restrictions. I think it was just the presence of an authority figure in the house that threw people off, because they were just kind of bastions of doing your own thing. I mean, whatever you wanted to do within reason, you could. And then you had this older woman who you didn't know, for one thing. I mean, you certainly had not entered fraternity life with this sort of a figure around. And then these rules were being made, and you had a lot more restrictions than you were used to.
I'm just real curious. Could the house mother be the one to say no sleepovers, or is that the university saying no sleepovers?
No, that was the house mother. I don't think the university, as far as I know.
And who hired the house mother? Did you hire her, or
the house mother was hired by the housing board or housing corporation? I think that's true with most of them. I think that perhaps the university solicited a whole bunch of house mothers at one time. I don't know. They may have put an advertisement in somewhere, and then the housing corporation that governs the fraternity would interview them and ultimately made the decision and wrote the checks. So
that must have been a real battle royal.
Yeah, it was. I mean, W&L is not a very, I mean, people are generally have good manners, but it's still sort of unrepentant in it. I don't know whether it is as much now, but it was 5 years ago. In terms of, it was male dominated for so long that it was still evolving when I left there. And I think that there were a lot of house mothers who had come from places that were used to having house mothers and were not prepared for the resistance that they encountered. And as a consequence, a lot of them did not stay very long.
The house mother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's no surprise. Can we go a few
sure,
more minutes?
That's fine.
I want to pop in another.
Sure.
My light's beeping at me.